Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about the program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show.
Welcome to episode 90, where we are discussing a book by James D. Thompson titled Organizations in Action, Social Science Bases of Administrative Theory, originally published by McGraw-Hill in 1967. This is part one of the episode where we will discuss the text and the many propositions that Thompson lays out as a foundation for administrative theory. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, this is Jared speaking to you from Sydney in Australia.
Hi, this is Michael coming to you from Utrecht in the Netherlands.
And this is Pedro coming to you from Copenhagen in a beautiful spring day.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States, where even in late April, we're still dealing with winter weather. it's amazing. Welcome, everybody, and welcome to another episode where we're going to discuss a classic of organization theory. This is James D. Thompson's Organizations in Action, Social Science Bases of Administrative Theory. And it was published in 1967. And just as sort of like a way of comparing this to other texts that we've read, this has very similar structure to March and Simon's Organizations we did just a few episodes back. In that, Thompson appears to be doing here is to take what was, as of 1967, the breadth of social science known at the time, and is trying to collect a whole bunch of propositions about administration. The book has two parts. Part one, which is sort of the basic structures or the basic understandings of organizations in general. And then part two seemed to be a little bit more topical. And they went into more depth about humans and organizations, complexity in organizations, the administrative process. You know, the idea that you have such a book that basically provides us a whole bunch of propositions that would then lend itself to further research, it makes it a very, very relevant and useful book. But it was a bit dense, not unlike March and Simon. What did you all think?
I think it was very enlightening, of course, and everyone has read the book knows that. That is a cornerstone in our understanding about organizations, right? It has a tremendous impact of the field and has one of those books that has given us the vocabulary and the way, even a paradigm through which we can think about how organizations, you know, function. But I think that unlike March and Simon, you know, I'm curious to see what I think about that. But I feel that Thompson is trying to be more open-ended in two ways. In one way, in terms of the paradigm, because he is trying to merge the ideas from rational and natural systems, right, and push that towards an understanding of the environment and trying to show that while rationality may be a goal or an ideal, you cannot just design organizations, right? Because we have learned from a natural paradigm, so to speak, that the human factor, the alternatives that come from the environment kind of get on the way and make things emerge. Right. But the point that is trying to do that by paying a lot of attention on the context or the environment that the organization is in, right? So it's going to push the understanding by look beyond just what is happening and what just is what is designed and emerging within. And the other way I think it's open-ended, it's also, although it's very proposition-based, right? It's a bit more eclectic, and it's trying to push the theorizing in terms of understanding organizations as dynamic, hence the title, and administration as something that is about an ongoing process of understanding, trying to manage all the sort of uncertainties and challenges and unpredictable issues that arise, right? So open, therefore, it's also in terms of the challenge of administration and also of organizational analysis, because there is no one final answer. So the challenge in front of the professional manager or the analyst is to try to cope with how, given certain set of conditions and set of contingencies, how one can go about continuously trying to strive to achieve particular goals and so on.
I think it's interesting that you stress this openness, Pedro, because reading the text, and Tom mentioned it, it's quite a dense book. It's very conceptual. It's got all these propositions, and it sometimes kind of feels like a closed argument. But in a sense, you're right, Pedro. It's very open to combining different perspectives, to opening up the discussions for the field. In the introductory chapter, he's really, you know, setting kind of the stage by caricaturing these, you know, the closed system and open system approaches, and setting the stage for having a more integrated perspective and a discussion between these streams in the literature. And yeah, well, that I think that's a very, very interesting opener and a strong thread throughout the book, and which I really liked for this classic piece, because it's several decades old now, but it's kind of groundbreaking for several streams within the organizational studies. I mean, population ecology, institutional theory, these are elements that are not so much mentioned because he didn't have the language at that point yet, but there are the building blocks for these streams within the literature that are really explicated within this book, and that's very interesting.
I might also add that the version that I have, I don't know which editions you had all read, but the edition that I have is one that has a new introduction by W. Richard Scott, who was one of the scholars in institution theory. And I use his book, Institutions and Organizations, for many other things. So, in some ways, when you see these updated editions and you see who contributes new introductions, new prefaces, or whatever, it sort of indicates, well, where was the impact of the book felt? And I think you hit that right on the head, Michael. I may also add that, when we talk about the propositions, it perhaps compared to March and Simon, where you had a very, very, very large quantity of propositions, and there was a little bit more of an effort to tie them to variables and to make them a little bit more immediately researchable. Thompson's propositions here, for the most part, and he even said so, I forget if it was in the conclusion or if it was in the introduction, he basically said that many of these are not really written to the point of being empirically tested per se. These propositions read much more like plain speak statements from which you could probably develop each one into a whole research agenda. And what was nice about it was that despite the density of the book, I could read through the propositions and I could get a clear sense of what he's trying to say. And there's applicability, there's utility that I can glean from that, even if I'm not directly involved in this area of research. It provides insight more as much as it does a direction for research.
I almost had the feeling that the propositions were less in terms of statements to be tested, and more in terms of the index of the logic he's trying to put forward, right? It's almost like you can just read the propositions and get a summary of the argument, but it's almost like breadcrumbs he's using for his own argument and to chart a path, given certain conditions, given this, given that, and the statements he builds upon each other, then we get a more refined kind of, outcomes that advance his argument, right? And I think it's a very, elegantly and smart, of course, done, because it starts by the more generic and universal and traditional and based on previous knowledge, and slowly advances more specific arguments related to the role of, human, the human factor and the environment and, all this kind of the different way of seeing administration, the particular way through which power is exercised and so on, which I'm sure we're going to talk more about in a second. Right. So he kind of uses them as building blocks for his own argument in the book.
Yeah, these propositions, they're kind of building blocks indeed for the book. And they're small they're one line summaries of the statements he makes, and they're fleshed out within the chapters. And I really like within the book that each chapter he really finalizes with a clear summary. So you not only have the propositions as a thread throughout the book, for quickly getting the core of the argument, but also the small sections at the end of each chapter, which is very useful if you're kind of skimming or only want to look at certain chapters within within the book. That's always convenient, of course, if a book tries to do that. The propositions, there's something interesting with that, I would say, because the whole book is, of course, centering around the idea of what is the role of rationality in controlling organizations from an internal perspective, but also in relation to the outside dynamics. And then there's this interesting thing where he kind of shares his ideas about rationality to a certain degree or certain point. But then the book itself is very, very rational. It has all these statements like, if X, then Y kind of suggestions in the way he talks about the subject. So while making this argument for opening up the space around rationality for organizations, he didn't really feel, in a way, the possibility to do this for his positioning in the field of organization studies per se. So there are open threads within the book, and there is this starting point for all these kinds of discussions that came later. But the book itself is very rational in the way it has been written.
I think this is particularly compelling in some points in which it talks about conflict and, you know, this kind of more, any kind of misalignments and tensions. But the assumption is that we can predict the source and the features and the nature of that, given, you know, some of the arguments it puts logically, right? But I think it makes sense because it's read it in context, right? It is a context of social sciences trying to model after a bit natural sciences and a particular paradigm of theorizing that is trying to, you know, be very grounded in deductive logic, much more than, for example, you know, theorizing and trying to depart from real life, complex, hard to understand, unpredictable kind of, you know, emergent behavior, right? It's trying to use information from that and then try to put it in a broader framework on what, you know, the kind of, you know, the noise we see in organizations, so to speak, what could be the result for that. And it's very compelling, it's very convincing, but of course, it has its own limits.
That's an interesting point that I think you make, Michael, around the language, perhaps, or some of the underlying thinking of Thompson and whether it reflects a rational way of thinking or theorizing. And it's not unsurprising because if, as you do, like Thompson, you create space for the notions of a rational system alongside an open or natural system, you already have opened yourself to a particular way of thinking, and therefore it kind of perhaps filters through the language there somewhat. I think also, you know, I hadn't thought about it before until Tom mentioned it and suggested perhaps the propositions are there and framed in a way to guide future research. And I think sometimes when we read these classics, we can situate them after time. We can situate them in the context of the kind of broader work of people like Thompson. And if you think of the role that he's had in trying to, presumably shape the field through the founding of journals like the Administrative Science Quarterly, I mean, maybe there is something in that, Tom. I hadn't thought about it, but he's definitely been someone who has shaped the development of organization theory, and maybe those propositions were a way of trying to guide future research.
Well, I think it's certainly one of the things that comes to mind whenever, in retrospect, when you see somebody who has been accomplished, as accomplished as Thompson is. Where did it come from? What was the genesis of that? I do want to get into some of the meat of the propositions themselves, because we've been talking about the book kind of generally. But, let's put this in context with what some of the things in which he said. I'll start with the propositions early, the first propositions, because the point was made. We're taking rationality or the rational systems and the natural system, and we're putting them together. Well, he starts, of course, with the rational system. And in chapter two, this is about trying to frame the start point, okay? And so then you can see where from here, this is what we have long understood about organizations, and here's how I'm going to put it in such a way that based on these propositions, then as we go into bits and pieces of, or pockets or subfields of organization understanding at the time, then we'll show how areas have further developed. the first one, and then chapter two, it's all under the norms of rationality. So really reinforcing the context. Under the norms of rationality, organizations seek to seal off their core technologies from environmental influences. What does that mean? Based on the literature at the time, that means that organizations, assumed to be rational organizations, would basically operate as closed systems. And every single one of these, by the way, it's a treasure trove of other classics that he's bringing in to develop these propositions. Several of their episodes, you know, he uses March and Simon, others from the Carnegie School. Anyway, under norms of rationality, this is 2.2. Organizations seek to buffer environmental influences by surrounding their technical cores with input and output components. Again, this is a way of characterizing how organizations and closed systems interact with the environment. So then, once he's laid this out in chapter two about what does, in his terms, a rational system look like, then the other chapters that follow in part one, which is basically laying down the context of organizations writ large, he goes to how they act, which is chapter three, how they're designed, chapter four, their structures and their capabilities, chapter five, and then goes on to how they assess, and that was chapter seven. In assessment, you know, how do we see, or, you know, if we're in a closed system or we're an organization under the rational system, how do we assess our performance? And he provides, for example, again and again, under norms of rationality, this is his proposition 7.1, assessors prefer efficiency tests over instrumental tests and instrumental tests over social tests. And the chapter, of course, defines exactly what these mean. So an efficiency test would be basically an objective measuring stick to show that do things faster, better, cheaper. An instrumental test is more of a process-oriented kind of a test. And a social test is more like a cultural thing. How do people feel about the performance or what have you? So, you know, I'm grossly oversimplifying. But the point is that by the time you get to chapter seven, he has not only established what the rational system is, but how it relates in all of these different pockets of research that have been ongoing at the time to try to understand what does this mean in terms of how we design organizations, how they assess themselves, etc. That I found to be a very, very effective. But again, it was sometimes challenging to wade through because he did introduce a whole bunch of terminology in the process of doing that, and sometimes I got lost in the terms.
And what I like about this setting up these propositions and all these statements, indeed, you're right, Tom, they're very much related to the internal system of the organization, the rationality, the core rationalities that are central to organizing. But within this part of the book, he's also connecting it with the environmental and external challenges for organizations. So when I was reading the first chapter, I was like, okay, we're going to read something about the internal rational system of the organization, and then we're going to the challenging perspective. But as he said in the introductory chapter, these are interrelated aspects. And within these chapters 2 to 7, he really uses these two perspectives together. So coming to the first proposition, under norms of rationality, organizations seek to seal off their core technologies from environmental influences. And there's something interesting because technologies in this sense is not the way in which we normally talk about technologies. It's much more the core central services an organization provides. So educating or policing, and in the way in how this is performed, that's the way he phrases technologies. But he immediately also relates us to these environmental influences and how such technologies are also related to output activities and kind of geared to one another is a term that he uses. So on and on again, he positions this rational perspective, the procedures that organizations put in place not vis-a-vis, but in the context of a broader environment. And I think it's in chapter two already that he refers to institutional arrangements that influence these technologies within organizations.
What I find compelling in this strategy is that he's trying to take serious the fact that organizations aspire to be rational, right? So it's kind of an ideal that they are trying to organize for, right? So I think that's that is the brilliance, right? It's not saying that it exists, but it's what they are trying to accomplish. So everything he brings is then to show the way through which they try to achieve that, the way in which they try to organize their coordination, the way they try to organize their design, right? All the stuff that Tom was listing, right? So they are trying to, the way they organize, to organize for that, right? So that's, you know, to go back to what I was saying, that, and I think it in this process, it tries to show indirectly how this is a continuous effort to aspire that. So to one extent, he makes it sound that it is something that is, it can be achieved, right? But also emphasize the continuous effort and challenges to get to that somehow.
What does help is how much he uses real world examples, at least as sort of teeing things up. And these are real world examples that are drawn from other case studies. And on the one hand, he is introducing a set of terms, but it's not like he's inventing these sets of terms. These are terms that were drawn from the literature of the time. Perhaps because we are looking back at it from 60 years later, the terms, you know, other terms have come into the vocabulary that perhaps we don't use the same terms nowadays. At the time, that was what was being used. And as long as we can keep that perspective, then the text does get a little bit easier to read. I'm just going to use one example, which is sort of at the front end of chapter 3, where chapter 3 is on the domains of organized action. That's the title of it. And so chapter 2 was where he sets up the context of the rational model. And now he's talking about, you know, what do organizations do? And the purpose of what he does is he uses a couple of examples about, producing automobiles, you know, an industrial example, and explains how you take raw materials and various, and technological processes and produce an automobile. This is one that I particularly highlighted. Consider the technology for treating medical ills. And it's good because here's basically a contrasting example of an organization. And then using the literature at the time, which was not what I'm familiar with, Levine and White, 1961, what they call, he introduces their term of domain. And the purpose for domain is to explain, it's very much like what Abbott did in professions, that an organization stakes out a domain that they see themselves as responsible for. So what is it that that they stake out for themselves, that they are responsible for, that's in their mission set, that describes who they are, whatever, so that then it's the knowledge, it's the technologies, it's everything that they do. And then from there, we get into the how the task environment emerges and what it is, how they translate that domain into specific sets of actions. When you can get back into the terminology at the time, it all makes sense. And then when he starts to explain the propositions associated about, under what kind of a domain do you have a certain tasks being performed or certain tasks being preferred? Do you concentrate or disperse? Like, for example, centralize or decentralize might be our terminology nowadays.
But yeah, the domain word is I mean, I think such a great word, because if you compare it to
ways how we describe it, I mean, we're talking about product portfolios or service portfolios or the way in which organizations see themselves and make choices in which services they provide. I mean, he gives the example of a university, and your university, Tom, specialized in different fields than mine, as is Pedro's or Jared's. And kind of describing this characteristic as a domain is, I would say, quite interesting. We lost this word in organizational analysis nowadays. I mean, it's not similar to the organizational field. That's something else. That's much more of a diverse arrangement of all kinds of organizations. This is very much related to the specific organizations and how they want to position themselves within their environment. And we're not looking at it as in a form as a domain, or maybe you could use the word habitus or something, but then it's also more of a field kind of word. So yeah, this idea of a domain, I'm intrigued by it, what it could provide for kind of future discussions. Maybe
I think it provides two things. I think first, it provides, and that is something that is a thread across the book, a focus on action, on task, right? So the way he describes technology is very much the task or the goals, objectives that the organization is trying to accomplish. So he's trying to put that as front and center in talking about the relationship between the organization and the environment. And the other thing he does that's very interesting is that he's trying to talk about the environment in a less amorphous way and to, you know, bring to the fore the extent in which the organization has a rational action to take, no surprise, in defining what its domain is, you know. So, and it shows how this is done in a kind of negotiated, processual, indirect way through which, you know, it depends on consensus. It depends on the extent there is a dependence to achieve the particular goal, then understanding what the organization is going to do or not do and how this is understood, right? And how the different strategies that can be in place to get the inputs necessary and put back the outputs. How in particular contingencies, because that's another threat, right? So it's trying to understand how particular conditions can lead to particular strategies that make more or less sense. So given particular situations and dependencies, how we may expect power relations to play out between the organization and environment and within the organization, and talking about the different strategies that can be put in place, right, to organize this interaction through contracts, through co-option, you know, and so on. Right. So I think that it's interesting that this language allows Thompson and, you know, later research to foreground these aspects that the environment is treated through a particular framework in which we can see the importance of the task. We can see the importance of the decisions being made of how to relate to the environment and understanding the mechanisms through which these are interconnected and rationalities. Again, to go back to the thread, is tried to be achieved given a set of challenges that the environment poses to organizations.
Another part, and I think it was the same chapter, because he started to talk about power relationships too. And when we start talking about the domains, you know, it's very, I was very much reminded of our episode on Abbott and what he called jurisdictions. But it was really a lot of the same kind of thing. How do you turn knowledge into action? In this case, I think domain may be a little bit, extend a little bit more beyond strictly focused on knowledge. But, you know, for example, what do you do with treating those tasks that are a bit more peripheral to your core domain? Do you subsume them or do you outsource them? Those sorts of things are things which he sort of poses as part of the proposition that under certain conditions, the organization may naturally want to expand its domain and subsume its peripheral task environment because of the interdependencies or something of that nature. And then there's another one where the contingency says it'd be better to outsource because the interdependencies are not so great and you want to protect your core. There's a lot of analogy to what we were discussing with Abbott in professional jurisdictions about how professions, a type of organization, postures themselves to dominate a particular domain.
There are two things I wanted to say is that when we start talking about that, we start to move to the discussion he brings about organization design, right? Which I think is maybe the point of departure from Abbott. They have a common thread, and I think it comes from the fact they're trying to both pay attention to multiple elements in a system and how their interactions determine possibilities, right? I think that's the revolutionary approach from Abbott, is trying to think of professions in interdependence in a system. And Thompson's kind of trying to do that by looking at the interdependent elements within and beyond the organization, right? But what he does, and then it becomes more interesting and specific, is, for example, when he talks about organization design and the extent in which virtual integration might be desirable or economies of scale and so on and so forth, right? He's trying to talk about organization design in terms of the extent it can help to deal with what he calls the technology and task environments and the contingencies that come with them, right? So what organizations put in place in order to deal with any kind of challenge that is, you know, thrown at them, so to speak, from the environment and the ways in which they structure their operations to prevent, to achieve, to attain, you know, best optimal scenarios and so on.
I mean, Tom, you mentioned in our discussion what a dense book it is. And just from, you know, the discussion we've had so far, you see on how many aspects of organizing he touches on. And I think one of the things that I always find interesting when we're reading classics is there's so much we take for granted about how we think about organizations. And the challenge is that fairly commonly held beliefs now were not held in the same way at the time of writing. And so it's always interesting to try and put yourself in the place of a reader of the time and let that shape the way these notions filter through as you read them. You guys were just touching on how he brings up issues of power and how they relate to people. And Pedro mentioned the thinking around contingency theories and how some of this work filtered through there. And the thing I like, you know, kind of stepping a little bit back about this book is it demonstrates something that I think is quite self-evident now, that organizations are very complex and, you know, simply classifying them in one way or another is never going to do justice to that complexity. And I think that's something that's really interesting or that I really like what Thompson's done here is he's created a space for multiple perspectives, is, you know, the rational alongside the open and the natural. And he said, organizations are all these things and more, and sometimes they're some of these things and other times they're not. And sometimes they some of these things in relation to certain parts of the organization, like you guys were talking about in the technical aspects of organizing. There's so much crammed in there, as you mentioned, Tom, and it's not a super long book, but there is a great deal that he covers in a short number of pages.
So I want to expand quickly on that because I think we kind of, you know, forgot it. And I think what is interesting, again, to acknowledge is that without books like this, we would not be here, right? And I think there would be departments about organizational research because it had to be established as a particular, you know, for the lack of a better word, domain of study. And he does at the beginning trying to say that the way organizations, you know, function, the behavior in organizations and the actions they take cannot be reduced to just psychological factors, right, to any kind of uncertainties they face, but there's something that has to be understood through impersonal situations, personal forces, right? I think he uses this vocabulary, impersonal mechanisms, which is similar to, you know, how Durkheim, you know, started sociology by talking about the social fact that exists and how it can be understood. He's trying to establish that the behavior and the actions of organizations need to be explained in light of the ways they are set up and the challenges that they face, which cannot be just ascribed to the particular leader or culture or situation, but is a level of analysis or dimension of analysis in and of itself that needs to be explained through that own set of elements that he brings to the, you know, that he creates and shows and makes an impactful explanation. And I thought this very relevant, especially in the second part, which I think we're going to get at some point, right? In trying to explain things like career and aspirations and power relations and, you know, people striving for prestige and status or also feeling frustrations in their job and work. And he's trying to show all of these things that could be understood as idiosyncratic or personal based are actually embedded in the nature of the jobs that are there, in the nature of the opportunities that they have, the way that the jobs are place in the organizational structure and how the kind of opportunities that fall from it.
Yeah, and I'll also add that it's the type of a book that one uses to try to describe and explain things and not so much what to do about them. And there's always a range, there's always a kind of a danger in a certain way if a book like this goes into the wrong hands and you start treating the propositions as more than what they are, propositions. I have one example. It was one I happened to have the book open to, which is Proposition 41A. Organizations employing long-link technologies and subject to rationality norms seek to expand their domains through vertical integration. We also have to remember that in the late 1960s, things like vertical integration meant one thing, and they may be thought about differently nowadays. As we're reading these, reading this as a classic, there's been quite a bit of a shift in terms of, for example, whether vertical integration is considered to be beneficial or not beneficial. And I think that that also kind of applies to some of these propositions that over time we may have decided, well, maybe that was what we were understanding back in the 1960s. It may not apply the same way now, or we may really be thinking about them differently. Don't know if that helps. But
maybe adding to that, the book is a classic itself, but it's also a classic of classics, right? So there are all these names mentioned in the book that's already been mentioned. I mean, Parsons, Merton, Weber, Stichkamp, just a few of them. Big sociologists integrated in this organizational perspective. I would agree with you, Pedro, that he's using sociological analysis, sociological imagination to understand the instrumental role that organizations play within society, but also for their members themselves, and how all these previously laid out sociological understandings in interpersonal dynamics are also visible within organizations and between organizations and their field. I think he's able to show this in maybe even better than in comparison to in-depth case studies by Selznick or Kaufman that we also discussed, precisely because he doesn't focus on one organization and diving deeply within that, but zooming out and trying to understand the phenomenon of organizations and organizing itself.
I think with that, we could probably go ahead and introduce part two of the book, because this is where I think, you know, now that he's laid out the framework and laid out the basic understanding, this really is where a lot of the more interesting, insightful, forward-thinking kind of, you know, for the time, for sure. If I was to highlight one particular chapter that drew my attention, it was chapter 10, The Control of Complex Organizations. And I think, Jared, this follows along very much with what you're talking about. You know, this is at a time when complexity was still somewhat of a novel concept, if I recall correctly. Buckley had his chapter on complex organizations in 1967. You know, some of the emerging ideas about what complexity means. It was actually a pretty straightforward chapter, using some pretty good examples. And it wasn't just the propositions that he raised, but also some other things about just understanding the complexity of decision making and how to think and reason about it, which is one of the early sections in this. He shows a possible table about how to think about certainty versus uncertainty in complex situations. It was insightful to think about, you know, complexity is something that we're very, very comfortable talking about nowadays because we've been imbued with it for some time. It was interesting to think about how some authors had started thinking about complexity, as in this case, a comparison between how you bound what is certain, what is uncertain, or what is understood versus what is not understood.
I also found the chapter a small gem, right? And I'm not someone that said it's control and know so much about it, but it seems that throughout the book and here as well, he's trying to advance some kind of very relevant ideas. So in the first part, he talks about power and he insists that we should not think of power as a zero-sum game, right? And I think that's kind of, you know, very astute. And he talks about considering power in the context of interdependence. So the idea if you have A and B, and, you know, one can become powerful in regard to each other, depending on in this interdependence, who has increased power towards each other. And bringing the attention to the environment and so on, it shows that, you know, someone in a particular position, if the environment changes, you know, can gain power vis-a-vis the organization and vice versa. So I think there's an interesting thing in trying to, again, bring this dynamic view, which is kind of hidden in the book, but it's a bit tacit to bear, meaning that it's not just because someone is in a position means that he or she has power forever, right? But it depends on the conditions, the contingencies, and the relationship between different components, between different people, and between the person and the organization. And he does a similar thing here in this chapter, because he's trying to talk about the control of complex organizations and moving the pole, so to speak, to this idea that he has of the coalitions that he's bringing from Sartre and Marx and so on, right? That we should not think of organizations as this pyramid type of structures, but given the complexity of what the organizations are trying to do, given the complexity of the environments that they have, given even the technology complexity and specialization within them, usually they're going to be governed through a coalition. And he talks about the different ways in which they emerge in different ways on how there is like they become too big. Then usually there is, you know, a core within the coalition, or sometimes when there's much uncertainty and complexity, actually the person that is able to manage the coalition is the one that gains power. You know, so it tries to bring this idea that true to everything else in the book is trying to bring this attention to the interdependence of the components, to this tension between achieving power and rationality, but dealing with the natural dynamics that emerge in interpersonal spaces, trying to think about how uncertainty from the environment and other sources try, you know, force organizations to organize in a particular way. Right. So I think that's kind of, you know, seems still kind of quite relevant, because in many ways we still sometimes fall prey of this idea of power as embedded in a particular position, and that is related to the particular, you know, top hierarchy, whatever, in the organization. But if you take this other perspective, you see that's actually something much more fluid that is cutting across as organizations trying to achieve their task, right?
Yeah, and this is also one of the earlier texts in which I saw the term inner circle. That's one that, as one who has worked in, you know, high levels of large complex organizations, it was interesting to see this idea captured in this way. Other sources, like there's a reading by C.S. Lewis called The Inner Ring. I don't know if you all had seen or heard of it, but it actually was written around the same time as this. It was a speech, and he talks about the desirability of being in the inner, what he called the inner ring or inner circle, same thing. There's that that aspect of, here in this book, we're talking about power in terms of how it is distributed or managed in ways that go beyond, you know, just the natural authorities and responsibilities. But there also, it also conjures the whole idea of the desirability of power and the positioning oneself compared to others and how these inner circles form. That whole discourse has been very much relevant ever since.
Yeah, I think this final chapter, in some ways, it's, I don't know if you guys feel the same, but it, in some ways it felt a little unusual tone to finish on, because as Pedro mentioned, it deals largely with power. And I mean, in some ways, that's not unsurprising, given though the title of the chapter is The Control of Complex Organizations. But I think what he does nicely here is start to map out how power unfolds is not uniform in organizations. It plays out differently depending on, you know, these coalitions, as Tom was mentioning, or these inner circles, and even is influenced by the technology at play and so on. But I think the first place in the book, from memory, that he brings up power is in chapter 8, which has a really quaint title. It's called The Variable Human, which I just found a little bit amusing. I mean, could they be anything kind of more self-evident? The first line of that chapter is that the human actor is a multidimensional phenomenon subject to the influences of a great many variables. I think from there he starts to build out that, yeah, organizations are comprised by people who have are made up by a range of different desires and motivations, and we're also part of these power structures or relationships, and a large part of organizations is how people try and navigate those and leverage them for their benefits and so on. So, yeah, I can see how this became such a formative text for discussions of power as well.
Yeah, that chapter also kind of reminded me quite a bit about the episode we did last year on job design. You know, we're talking about organization design, of course, and that's sort of a big centerpiece of what he had early in the book. But there's no question that chapter 8 gets into a lot about the agency that individuals have to shape their own environments, their own individual task environments, or not. Because there are certain circumstances in which an organization, you know, using rationality, that an organization would want to impose itself upon the individual and seek conformity. How many episodes have we done on case studies where socialization and other things, you know, other factors tried to enforce some degree of integration and commonality or what have you? But there's the questions of under which circumstances, such as boundary spanning jobs or others where, let's say, the individual's ability to handle the organization's dependence on some other part of the organization, how many different ways in which an individual could do some of their own job designing, some of their exercise, some of their own autonomy in order to basically further their own needs. You know, this is also where he got into the career problem. It was very, very refreshing to see that. And because it came before the chapter on complex organizations, it actually sort of lends itself. Here's all of this variability in the human, and this is how it translates at a macro level across, you know, with all these variable humans. In a complex environment now, you have to be able to arrange power structures, build coalitions or what have you, in order for the organization to get things done, which then lends itself very nicely to the final chapter, the final major chapter, which is explaining the administrative process. So what is the purpose of administration? That's sort of the subtitle of the book, is about administrative theory. This is basically where he takes us at the end. After all of this, of what we understand about organizations, this is the purpose of administration.
And then he goes into detail on the co-alignment, right? So I like this term co-alignment, and right at the beginning of that that chapter, somewhere in the second paragraph, there's the statement: perpetuation of the complex organization rests on an appropriate co-alignment in time and space, not simply of human individuals but of streams of institutionalized action. Survival rests on the co-alignment of technology and task environment with a viable domain, and of organization design and structure appropriate to that domain. And for me, that was like really putting it all together, all the previous chapters. And in a way, it feels a bit simple, like, okay, we had all these complexities, rationalities, different forces, and now let's co-align everything. So he was kind of, seems like he needed to search for something to put it all back together. But I think he kind of succeeded in that in this final chapter. He's quite convincing in how he puts it back together again. And the complexity of the organization, the element of time and space that he puts in this process of organizing and administrating, that's a strong element of finishing the book. And in a way, the administrative function, or his discussion on the role of an administration in the organization, is kind of in depth. I mean, the previous chapters didn't so much go into the bits and pieces of administration in a sense, but here in this final chapter, he really goes into this idea of adaptive and directive action and how administrative processes assist an organization in that sense.
I don't know if it is my interpretation, which is probably biased, but I felt that he waited until the end because he's trying to invert the idea that administration is a function or a role or a class of people, and actually say that, put it on its head and say that administration is what organizing is, right? Because he says that there is an inherent paradox in administration, that, you know, everything is always changing, but organizations are striving for certainty somehow. So, you know, the word is as the natural system would predict, but the goal of organization is try to achieve a particular task and operate under some sort of rationality, right? And when he says that, he also says that somehow managing and organizational analysis or whatever operates in kind of bridging this gap, right? So trying to understand and manage the gap between what we design and what happens. And he makes a series of indirect arguments that it is not just done by the top layer, upper echelons or whatever, which builds on his arguments about coalition, different ideas of power, and so on and so forth, right? And this eternal need for adjusting and, you know. So he kind of makes it sound that administration is actually a collective process, not just done by one individual, but it's actually done, you know, through, and I think he uses words, a process flowing through the actions of various members, you know. So it's not just done at one level of the organization, but it's spanning and linking levels, you know. So it's a process that simply flows down from one level to the next, but a process related to the interaction of levels and components, which in a way he captures by this idea of co-alignment, which can almost think as this collective orchestration. And he also talks about that the challenge, therefore, is one of trying to continuously manage the fact that organizations are in the nexus of the environment and all the different things that are changing, and trying to continuously find its place in trying to accomplish a task, managing all the uncertainties and noise that is being thrown at the organization. So I think that was kind of a very beautiful, elegant way of inverting our ideas about managing administration and showing that that is actually something that is done collectively, is a continuous effort, and depends on this continuous striving for manage the challenges that are imposed upon organizations as they try to operate rationally, achieve its goals.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.